everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week, we're very pleased to have James Zug on the show. His new book, The Guardian, The History of South Africa's Extraordinary Anti-Apartheid Newspaper, has just appeared from Michigan State University Press. Prior to reading the book, I knew next to nothing about modern South African history, at least any more than the average reader of the average daily paper might know. James has answered a lot of questions for me, and he reminded me of something that I had forgotten, and that is that at mid-century, communists, much maligned today, were on the right side of many issues, one of them being racism. I really enjoyed my discussion with James, and I hope that you enjoy listening to it. Here's the interview. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. How are things in D.C.?
Things are hot and steamy.
Hot in D.C., yeah. Well, they're hot and steamy here, too. Luckily, there's no rain. The biblical flood is subsiding now. So, and I didn't have to build an ark or anything like that. I promised last week to somebody that I'm going to build an ark, and I did not build an ark. So, anyway, we're happy to have Jim Zug on the show today, and his new book, The Guardian, The History of South Africa's Extraordinary Anti-Apartheid Newspaper, has just come out from Michigan State University Press. And, I will just show my cards right now and tell you that I read the book and thought it was absolutely wonderful, and I hope that it finds the readership that it deserves. Let's begin, though, Jim, by having you tell our audience a little bit about yourself. So if you could just give your brief bio, that would be great.
Well, my favorite color used to be red, and now it's green.
Okay.
I'm still wavering on ice cream, but vanilla. Mm-hmm. I'm still a vanilla guy. I grew up in Pennsylvania and Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, and went to Dartmouth, and that's where I first got interested in the story of the Guardian newspaper. And I spent 3 years living in South Africa just after college, where I spent a year teaching at a high school, African high school, and then 2 years in Cape Town working on the Guardian book.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a master's in nonfiction writing from Columbia in the late 90s, and have been a freelance writer, historian, ever since then.
Well, we should actually talk a little bit about that. We don't have to do it right now, but I know that a lot of the listeners to the podcast are interested in anybody who makes a living writing, because it's a very difficult thing to do. So whenever I have somebody on the show who actually makes money that way and puts together a livelihood, I always ask them. But tell me this, what took you to South Africa originally?
Well, we had some family friends there, and my parents had been there. So at Dartmouth, you have to take a semester off. It's a four semester a year system, and so you have to go sophomore summer to Dartmouth. So you have to take a term off. And so I connected with some of these friends and spent 3 months in South Africa. Half of that in Cape Town, living with a couple of different families, and I worked at a what's called a colored school in Cape Town for a couple of weeks, and then I more or less just hitchhiked around the country, going from friend to friend. Somebody would pass me along, and I just fell in love with the country and its people and its history, and it's just an incredibly beautiful and sort of tragic place. So I came back to Dartmouth passionate about South African history, and did my rest of my studies sort of around that story.
Let me ask you what may seem like an aggressive question, but is it meant to be that way? Why no PhD in history? Why did you just sort of...
Well, yeah, it's funny. My wife, who teaches history in the high school level, we both have always talked about that. And I, the short answer is I sort of feel that I didn't want to get pinned down in one particular area. I've written books on 18th century exploration and the history of the game of squash and South Africa. And, I've sort of been able to bounce around and follow up my whims. And I always felt, it's not really true, but I've always felt that, you know, professors really get locked in and know all they need to know about one obscure part of one little tiny thing, and they're not able to kind of have a have a blanket passions on all different kinds of subjects. So that's one answer. The other answer is I was just intellectually lazy and got intimidated by having to know about Derrida and Foucault the sort of the theory of history, which I'm certainly not as passionate about compared to the actual, you know, the stories of people.
Mm-hmm, so, Well, I have to say, I don't think you were wrong when you very wisely thought, at a young age, I might add, that professors do get locked into small subjects, because that does in fact happen. And I know that in my own career, I, as we talked about in the pre-interview, I came to know more and more about less and less. I mean, I wrote books that were so ridiculously obscure that I don't even think my mother read them. She said she did, but I don't.
No,
I don't think
your mother.
Did.
Your mother's supposed to be one of the seven people who read what academics write.
She didn't. No, I don't think anyone ever read anything that I wrote. Well, maybe they did. I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure. But you know, you're absolutely right. And for those of our listeners that are thinking about going on to get PhDs in history, it really is very technical, and they do require you to work on one subject your entire life. You know, it's really quite a remarkable thing. I mean, it's funny because my wife, who's a mathematician, when I told her this about historians, just looked at me, as they say in Ireland, you know, she was just gobsmacked.
Yep.
Because she couldn't believe it, because no mathematician would work their whole life on one subject.
Right.
But historians commonly do this. I mean, if you're, as I was, a Russian historian at the beginning, you're a Russian historian at the end. And that can be tough. It really can. And so I applaud you for you know, taking the leap, and it was quite a white move.
Well,
white move on your
you know, I feel guilty about it a little bit. I've gone to a couple conferences with this book and been amazed how wonderful it is and intellectually stimulating to go to these conferences, and that, you know, my impression was always that academics kind of were squirreled away in their little offices, mm-hmm. and occasionally drifting out to scold their TAs for not covering their class. But you know, in reality, there's a whole great intellectual ferment that goes on that they get to. I mean, I was loving these panel discussions in these papers being given, and I came away. You know, came home thinking, oh, you know, maybe I should have done a PhD. But and I love teaching. I love working with other people who are interested. But I found that the MFA and they're, I think, increasingly popular for the nonfiction side of it, as opposed to going to journalism school, which is, you know, sort of a 9-month grind and not nearly as intellectual. And I really did enjoy my time at Columbia and found it very, very useful, both in terms of my writing and just my development as a reader. So it did work out for my career, as it were, to just do an MFA and not go on to the PhD. But
I see what you mean, and I do think that many people enter history graduate school and think to themselves, well, you know, I just like to read books, and maybe I'll write a few of them myself, and you know, I'm a pretty fluent reader and pretty fluent writer, and this is what I'll do, and I'll talk to people about history. But in fact, it's usually extraordinarily technical, and I don't think people realize that.
When I read that stuff, I don't understand what people are saying.
Yeah, well,
and,
often,
you know,
yeah, I don't.
And so
I write it, and I don't understand what I'm writing. So
But I think, you know, I think my first book is this book, The Guardian, and I felt at a young age, and probably not so much today in my dotage, that I wanted to have an impact and do a book, do an article that can change people's lives. And I didn't feel that sort of being in academia,
Well, it's a different sort of game, actually. I mean, I know that from my own academic work, I think I have contributed something to the narrative of Russian history. Let's put it that way. In other words, there are facts that I have established that no one had established before. You know, but I haven't done a very good job of discussing their broader significance, and I think that in general academic historians aren't very good at that. But then again, we have people like you to rely on who can take our work and make it
understandable. Well, I feel like there's this whole group of historians, popular historians, who kind of conglomerate and they take all the work that academia produces and they sort of translate it into English.
Yeah, no, that's right. Yeah.
And you know, McCullough, and I mean, you just sort of go through all these people who actually sell books, And a lot of them, you know, they just completely, you know, lean on on the academics. And so there is this kind of conduit role that I think popular historians can play.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And also the skills are quite different. I mean, I know that I have many colleagues, not to say that they're bad writers, but don't really know the idiom of popular history very well. And
they're not willing
to sort of to take the shortcuts that are necessary in order to tell a story telegraphically. And I know that it was difficult for me to do when I first started doing it. I kind of bridled against it. I think I've learned how to do it now, but it is a different sort of project. And you know, I think that, you know, as I said, in this book you've negotiated it wonderfully.
Well, thank you.
So let's talk a little bit about the book itself. You say that its origins came out of work that you did as an undergraduate, but that was I was about to say that was a long time ago. You're an old man.
I know. I'm nearing 40. The story was I spent a summer before senior year working with this very sort of liberal group in Berkeley, California. They were liberal even for Berkeley. And they did work transferring technology and technological skills to Nicaragua, to the Sandinistas. Mm-hmm. And they had gotten involved with helping the ANC outfit their offices in Lusaka. And they started a brand new project right when I got there, which was working with two black-owned and run newspapers, one in Joburg and one in Cape Town. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to connect these newspapers with the broader continuum of South African history and alternative newspapers. And so they asked me to go prove that these papers were sort of connected to that.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept on running into this one newspaper, or actually it seemed like three or four. It was hard to kind of get a handle on its history because its name kept on changing and people didn't seem to realize it was the same paper. And it seemed very, you know, interesting and important, and nobody would write more than a paragraph on them in these histories of the South African press. And so I went back to Dartmouth and wrote my thesis on that newspaper, which involved mostly just reading all 1,400 issues over 26 years of when it was published every week. And I finished that thesis in May of 1991, and then the next leg of the story is I was living in South Africa, and the archives of the liberation struggle in Cape Town, this center heard about my thesis, got a copy of it, and asked me to come to Cape Town and talk to them about it, and I did, and they asked me to write, turn it into a book, and they would publish it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was 23 and had just spent a year teaching, and it had resolved that I was going to become a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of weeks later, I was offered a book contract.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, this is very easy. this is the way I should do it.
Yeah.
And that was in December of 1992, and the book was published in November of 2007. And not by those people either. But so that it had an incredibly long, you know,
gestation period. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it did come out. But I did work on it. It was sort of my first book that I did write in the mid 90s.
So you made numerous trips to South Africa, and you worked in archives there, and you read all the newspapers.
Yeah, I just moved back there, and just lived there for 2 years in Cape Town, and worked at this archives, helping put it together. But mostly spent time interviewing people around the country and visiting archives around the country and in England to get the story of this newspaper and its staffers. And so I did that for a couple of years and wrote a brand new draft. And then one thing and another happened with the publishers. But so I was there for so I was there during the transition to democracy in 1994, et cetera.
That's incredible. Yeah, I think the one thing that I'm always reminded, whenever I have to deal with publishers, the thing that I always think, maybe this is the Midwestern in me, is that they don't work on Fridays. there's something wrong with that. I don't. they can't really be trusted, publishers. They don't
I had an editor who didn't work on any day.
Yeah, right. They take weeks off in the summer and then they work on Fridays. What kind of live employee is that? I don't get it. So anyway, why don't we go ahead and talk about the story itself? So set the scene and tell us about the people that founded The Guardian.
Well, they were this very idealistic group of trade unionists, mostly white trade unionists, liberals, a great contingent from the University of Cape Town, these professors, who felt the need to have a liberal paper, one that covered organized labor movement in Cape Town, and were opposing fascism, which was becoming a huge problem in South Africa in the late 30s, and which ultimately led to the apartheid regime coming into power in 1948. So they were right to be worried, and it was focused on Cape Town and on sort of white working class issues mostly, and it evolved in the 1940s into a paper allied with the Communist Party of South Africa, which was the only non-racial party political movement in the country, and the sort of backbone of the liberation movement as it is even today, and in South Africa, and they it kind of segued into being a part of the Communist Party, and then the party was banned in 1950. And the paper evolved into being the organ of the African National Congress, and the ANC was banned in 1960, and it evolved into sort of the organ of the underground ANC and its armed guerrilla wing. And then it got it run out of existence in 1963. It was banned three times by Pretoria, and the following week it came out every Friday. The following Friday it would come out with a new title, and same editors, same distribution network, same editorial policy, same photographers. Everything was exactly the same except for a new name. And so they were able to survive these bannings, even though they're very disruptive. And it was sort of hounded out of existence when the apartheid regime decided not to worry about the paper, but to house arrest all the people working at the paper and forbid dozens of people from being involved with the publication of a newspaper. And by 1963, everybody was sort of underground or in exile or in jail, and they couldn't find anybody else to put it out. So they closed it on their own 2 days before they were forced to.
What was the political climate like in the 1930s when the paper was founded?
The South African government was sort of a segregationist government, relatively benign in comparison to what came in after 1948. The paper had sort of friends in the government. The Minister of Labor was a friend of the paper, et cetera. There was a great upsurge of interest in the Soviet Union and communism, and a great acceptance of communism after Hitler invaded the Soviet Union in June of 1941. The Communist Party benefited greatly, and so the newspaper did. But in the 30s, things were a bit more of a struggle, both for the paper and for sort of the radical left of South Africa.
And how was it the case that the founders of the paper themselves, were they South Africans, or were they imports from England?
They were all South African except for the first editor, Betty Radford, who's this wonderful tragic persona. She come out of South Africa in 1931 to visit relatives and stayed on and become a journalist, and she married one of the leading sort of theoreticians in the radical left, this surgeon in Cape Town, and they honeymooned in Europe and in Russia, but we're not members of the Communist Party or anything.
Honeymooning in Russia in the 30s.
Oh yeah,
that is quite a picture. I can only imagine what they said. So they were. Would you call them fellow travelers then?
They were at that time. I mean, maybe not they weren't even traveling so much, but they got that way, and they joined the party in 41, just before the invasion. She became a member of the Cape Town City Council representing the party. Her husband ran for parliament representing the party. And they were big hitters, very big hitters in political circles in South Africa. When things got tough after the Second World War, there was a great reaction against the party and against radical political thinking, in large part because of a mine strike up in Joburg, the political climate changed overnight. Betty was arrested as part of the backlash of the strike, and they basically dropped away politically and socially from the party and from the sort of radical left, and eventually went into exile. And it was sort of a tragic end that, you know, they dropped away completely, and there was sort of bitterness on both sides, sort of a sad end. And they went into exile, and her husband eventually worked at the Lancet, the British. Medical journal.
Now, the Communist Party in the 1930s, it had just been started in South Africa, hadn't it?
No, it started in 1921. It was the successor of another organization that was founded in 1915, and so it really does date to 1915, but officially was founded in 1921, and in the 20s was quite a strong organization. The ANC, which was founded in 1912, was a very quiet organization of just a few members, and not terribly active at all until the 1950s. And so the ANC the party was the one that did the grunt work, the organizing. They ran night schools and issued newspapers and did the organizing, set up the meetings, et cetera, and you know, continued to do that through the 90s, but they were much more politically active in the 30s than the ANC.
Mm-hmm. But in the initial years of the paper, there wasn't any formal association with the Communist Party. It was only with the invasion of the Soviet Union that...
Yes, and that was in part because the party had gone through this incredible sectarian purging in the 30s. Basically, the party leadership that was in favor of working with Africans and black South Africans, they were trumped by the people interested more in class and interested in white South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And the leader of that, of the race group, S.P. Bunting, his son Brian Bunting was the editor of The Guardian for its last 15 years. And Brian actually just died a week ago.
Oh, really?
And I saw him quite a bit when I was in Cape Town just earlier this month. But so there was all this purging, and basically the party ceased to exist anywhere outside of Johannesburg.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was no official active party in Cape Town when the paper was started. And people who had been communists or were, you know, fellow travelers, they did their political work in other organizations. And so there really was no party to speak of until 1939, and it really didn't take off until the war. So they didn't really have to worry about the party because it didn't really exist.
So what issues were at the forefront in the 1930s when the paper was coming out?
The fascism was a big problem, fighting that amongst conservative Afrikaners.
So there was an active fascist party in the 1930s?
Yes, a number of them in South Africa. They, you know, attacked communist party communist speakers. The ships of, you know, refugees they would attack. So that was a visceral problem. And they were just trying to conditions for Africans and for poor whites were terrible back then. as they remained for Africans throughout the century and even today. And so they that's what people were worrying about, was housing and jobs. I mean, you know, there was a big fight, I think, in 37 or 38 to cut back on the hours that shop assistants had to work in Cape Town.
Mm-hmm.
They were sort of working inhumane hours.
Mm-hmm.
So they tried to get them to have Friday nights off. I think that was the big campaign.
I'm going to have to wear my ignorance on my sleeve. Who's the ruling party in the 1930s? Who was actually governing South Africa?
Well, the prime minister was Jan Smuts, who was a World War I hero. And the sort of simple answer is that they were English-speaking white South Africans who had descended from the UK, immigrants from the UK, as opposed to the Afrikaner, which are sort of a mixture of Dutch and other people.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the sort of shorthand, but it's much more complicated than that. But basically, what English-speaking South Africans always have said is, you know, well, we ran the country, and then in 48, the Afrikaners took over, and we lost control.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not really the case.
I was going to say, is that true? I just don't think that's
right. Yeah, in one respect. I mean, most English-speaking South Africans benefited greatly from the apartheid years, and so it was easier for them to sort of wash away their guilt by saying, well, you know, we don't support them and we don't vote for them.
Right.
Which was all true. It took a couple elections for the Afrikaners to get a majority of the white vote, but or the National Party to get a majority, but certainly they were, you know, extremely complicit.
Uh-huh, I see. So maybe you could talk a little bit about the ethnic scene in South Africa, and this is something that I knew vaguely but didn't know very much about, the ethnic classification, because you said there were various different groups which wouldn't be familiar to Americans.
Well, under apartheid there was four ethnic groups, and everybody was classified, and people would switch classifications based on extremely dubious methods of determining which class you were in. But there was whites, Africans, Indians, who mostly descended from people who had been brought into the country in the 19th century to work the sugarcane fields in Natal, and coloreds, which were a distinct ethnic group that came from a mixture of Malay slaves and the offspring of relationships between Afrikaners and Africans, in addition to there were two other groups of people living in South Africa when the Dutch arrived in 1652, and those groups all interacted as well. And so anyway, by the 20th century, there was a distinct ethnic group called the colored people, and are still there today, very much so. They have different subgroups, but a lot of them are Muslim, and a lot of them are almost indistinguishable in many ways from the Afrikaner. They both speak Afrikaans as their mother tongue, and they worship in the same churches, and have the same passions for rugby, and it's very hard to tell the difference between some of them. So that the colored group, very important in terms of literature and social life and politically in South Africa, and a lot of them live in the Cape, in around Cape Town.
Mm-hmm. So did these ethnic groups break out along political lines in the 1930s?
No. I mean, they all had their own political organizations, and one of the interesting things that was happening was that the Indian and colored groups, especially the Indian groups, both in the Transvaal and in Natal, which have been very conservative, much like the ANC, they began to liberalize, and a bunch of young, more militant Indians came into power in those groups, and they led, they very much influenced by Gandhi, who had, you know, lived in South Africa for decades, and so they became much more radical and started doing mass protests and civil disobedience, which then led to the ANC doing that in the 1950s when the ANC became a mass organization. The colored people were traditionally more conservative. They had a large strain of Trotskyism, which basically, in some part, became they were just a group that didn't do a lot of political action, spent a lot of time talking, but didn't want to be involved in political work. So the political situation in South Africa has always been very complicated with these sort of historical roots that still determine what's going on today in the country.
I see. So what position did the founders of The Guardian, what position did they take in the 1930s on racial issues? Were racial issues important at the time to them?
Well, they were, but they weren't, you know, they were still getting their heads wrapped around the idea that the core issue, what was going on in the country, was not so much a class issue, but a racial issue, that that the majority of people couldn't vote back then and didn't have basic civil rights, and so they struggled with that. I mean, there was sort of a upper class feel to the paper, and a sort of white feel to the paper those first couple of years, where they really weren't committed to, you know, national liberation. And that certainly evolved in the 40s to where, you know, by the end of the 40s they were you know, fully committed to what the, you know, ANC was fighting for.
This expression national liberation, what does it mean exactly?
Well, we got it in 1994.
Okay, yeah, I see. Okay.
For decades they felt that national liberation would mean some tanks rolling through Pretoria, and up until the mid 80s that was the preferred method of getting one man, one vote.
One man, one vote, and also black rule then.
Well, that necessarily would be, yeah.
Yeah, right.
Not necessarily, no, but just allowing everybody to vote. I mean, many coloreds had voting rights up until the 50s. So they were always trying to retain those.
Right. No, I see. What you mean.
But basically, yeah, the vast majority of South Africans never voted until 1940. And even when I was just there 2 weeks ago, people are still, you know, talking about what it was like to vote, you know, for the first time, and the incredible scenes at the polling stations, which I saw when I worked at a polling station there.
That's amazing. That's really interesting.
And, you know, we take it so much for granted. I mean, I remember ever since I came back from South Africa, I always have voted in every little, tiny, major, small thing.
Yeah.
Even though I don't have representation since I live in the district in Congress. But, you know, you until you see people waiting, you know, 6 or 7 hours.
Yeah.
Aligned to cast their first vote in their lives. They're 80 years old. You don't really understand democracy.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, that's a moving thing to see, I imagine.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how did the editors and writers at the paper negotiate their relationship with the Communist Party in the 1940s, specifically with the Comintern, because there were some complicated things going on there that, you know, again, one of the things that I found very refreshing about your book is that it reminded me how difficult it was to be a communist in the late 30s and in the 40s and then of course in the early 50s, because you didn't know whether to take your orders from the Soviet Union, you didn't know whether to go on your own, you didn't want to be a deviationist, you didn't want to be a socialist, you didn't want to join the liberals, you didn't want to be a unionist. Exactly how did they negotiate that?
Well, the party was completely independent from Russia in the 40s, and they were very isolated from the Comintern, you know, which went out of existence. But they were, South Africa was incredibly isolated back then. I mean, they didn't get television until the mid 70s.
Mm-hmm.
There was no radio to speak of until the early 60s. They were just, you know, and before jet planes and stuff. I mean, it took months to get get down there. They were very isolated, and they there was a the party was people had an interest in communism, in Marxist-Leninist thought, but they're very much more focused up until when everybody went into exile in the early 60s. They were very focused on what was going on in the country and on supporting the ANC and moving towards democracy. And certainly class issues were always being brought to the front burner, and people were saying, "Oh yeah, we got it," and then brought back to the back burner. That they were always aware of the fundamental issues on the ground. You know, issues about passes, all Africans had to carry a identity book. Issues about rate increases with rent or buses.
Mm-hmm.
These sort of core primary issues that were affecting Africans' lives, so being a communist was, obviously it was a very bizarre thing in the Cold War. In the early 40s, it was an exciting thing, and a communist got elected to parliament, and he was, you know, this sort of great hero of the party in the 40s. But after the mine strike and the Cold War setting in, communism became kind of a catch-all for anybody opposing the government. And when they put the Suppression of Communism Act, which became law in 1950, not only was the party driven out of existence, but you know, any kind of political opposition was, you could be called a communist, even though you might not be at all, if you sort of oppose the government. And they used the communist bogey to great effect well until the 80s. So many of my friends who grew up in South Africa, white South Africans, would always, they just like sort of tell you how they've been raised to, you know, the communist bogey, that these ANC terrorists were going to come in and slit their throats. So communism was a dirty word, but for the, and politically it was a great word, because it just gave people a structure and a way to be involved politically in a non-racial way, which was very unusual. I mean, the ANC didn't even accept white members until 1969, and couldn't be on their executive committee, which ran the association, ran the Congress. You couldn't be on that if you were white until 1985. So
it was it was the only interracial party in South Africa at the time.
The Communist Party was, yes.
That's amazing. I had no idea about that. So, but there were moments at which I thought this was really quite fascinating, because you know, one of the things that, and I say this in my write-up on the website, one of the things that I always, I guess I'm one of those people that does tend to use the broad brush when talking about communists and think of them as kind of evil. But the fact of the matter was, they were right on the right side of this issue. But there were some things that they did, and you point them out bravely, I think, that they were on the wrong side of certain issues. Like, for example, in 39, they came out against the war.
Yeah.
And why did they do that exactly?
Well, that was a very complicated problem, and communist parties all over the world struggled with it and came out one way and then had to reverse their decision. And it was a real conundrum, because if you came out against the war, you were also hanging out with the neo-Nazis.
Exactly.
In South Africa, the Nazis in South Africa, neo-Nazis.
Yeah.
So they had a lot of trouble, and I mean, everybody kind of smirked when they joined the war effort, the Allied effort, in 1941, almost 2 years later, you know, simply because, you know, now the Soviet Union, you know, the great socialist communist country was being attacked, so now they could come out in favor of the war.
Right.
So it caused a little bit of intellectual gymnastics that a lot of people laughed at. But so everybody was very relieved when Soviet got attacked in a way.
Exactly.
But it was an awkward 2-year period.
Yeah, I imagine. So there was also some moments at which, you know, they would go to the Soviet Union for various reasons. They would come back with these glowing reports, which you know, is not atypical at all among fellow travelers and Communist Party members. Did any of them say publicly or to one another, I suppose, you know, that things were, you know, kind of things had gone awry in the Soviet Union?
Oh, yeah. I mean, very few people didn't say that. Brian Bunting was sort of one of the few people who didn't. And I just wrote an obituary about him. Where that was the sort of turn of the article was about that. But for a lot of people, you know, the moment of disillusionment came one way or another, you know, came in with Hungary in 56. It came after Stalin's death. You know, there were these periods where it, you know, became increasingly clear what was going on. But yeah, people did go to the country, to the Soviet Union, and were buffaloed. With hindsight, we go, God, this is crazy. This is, you know, by far and away the worst regime of the 20th century in terms of the number of people directly killed by it. And yet you know, back then, communism for South African political activists meant, you know, the way to liberate your own country.
Yeah.
And so they did have a loyalty to it, but they weren't nearly as interested in it. And, and some of them did, you know, write about it, and they were squashed down. There was a great intellectual in the 1950s named Lionel Forman, who worked on the newspaper and was even editor for a while. And he had lived in the Eastern Bloc in the 50s for a couple of years, so he knew more about what was going on. And after Hungary, he wrote some columns saying this is outrageous. And after the first one was published, the party, which was then underground, said, "Look, you know, you can't write another column." And they reversed the analysis on what was going on in Hungary. And you know, under protest from Lionel Forman, so there were people who were speaking out. But you know, it was one of the great intellectual tragedies of the 20th century was this loyalty towards Russia, which turned out, you know, now that we know, especially since the archives have opened in the 90s, was the worst regime of all.
Yeah, I guess I would say we knew long before the archives opened, that's sort of another story. Yeah,
but there was, you know, the absolute proof of it.
Yeah,
I mean,
sure.
Robert
Conquest
or whatever, you know, like this lone voice saying, actually, these guys are really bad.
Yeah.
So I think they you know, certainly the South African Communist Party struggled mightily in the 80s and, you know, in the 90s to come up with its reasons for existing and where its loyalties lay.
Yeah.
And certainly that's been a great problem in South Africa since 1994 because South Africa has become a kind of liberal capitalistic state. And the ANC and the party were very much, you know, committed to turning it into a communist economy. They haven't done that at all, and many people on the left in South Africa today are completely disgruntled with what the leadership has done in terms of the economy.
Yeah, you bring up the point. I was actually my next point, my next question, and that is, what was the relationship between the ANC and the Communist Party at the time, and the paper? Because the paper, at sometimes the other parts of the press would say, well, the, you know, the Guardian, it is a, or whatever it was called at that time, it is the organ of the ANC, or it is the organ of the party. But they disavowed that quite a bit, didn't they?
Well, they did. I mean, they did that partly just for practical reasons, so that they wouldn't get in trouble when the party or the ANC was banned. It was sort of, you know, a political maneuver, but and certainly they were very, you know, very much close to the party, especially and to the ANC. The paper acted as a kind of glue that brought the two entities together. There was great wariness between them in the 20s and 30s and 40s. And, you know, somebody like Nelson Mandela was very much against working with the party in the 40s. But the paper was this was sort of this mechanism to bring them together. It helped translate sort of Marxist-Leninist thought into the African idiom, and so that Africans could understand how this might play out and what was going on, and understand what was actually, you know, the sort of larger issues behind their way of life and their standard of living. So and it also it just brought the people together, the communists, you know, who were selling the paper, and the Africans that they were reporting on in their political struggle. So a lot of people have said, you know, without the newspaper, the alliance between the two organizations would have never happened, and that probably is true to a certain extent.
Did the ANC have its own newspaper?
No.
Really?
They didn't. They did have one that was very irregularly produced, and it went out of existence before The Guardian was founded. And though they tried a couple of different times, they never were able to get a new one off the ground. And so they've never had their own publication since 37.
So tell us how The Guardian came to be closed down once and for all.
Well, they kept on sort of surviving.
They changed their name about six.
I know. I mean, it's and people, you know, I was the first person in a way to say, okay, look, this is all one newspaper, and here are the dates. When you rent the microfilm, you have to rent it from four different places because it's not all, you know, cataloged as one newspaper. But they were banned in 52, and then in 54, and then in 62. And when they were banned in 62, the government thought, aha, we've done it the right way, because before they were banned, the government put in a new law that said anybody starting a newspaper, a new newspaper, has to put down a deposit of £10,000, which was...
That's a lot of money, isn't it?
It's a lot of money today,
yeah.
Let alone back in 62.
Yeah.
So just before that law became bill became a law, the paper bought a couple newspapers and started publishing them, but they only would publish five or six copies. It pretended to be a regular newspaper, but they only published the copies that they had to send to the various museums and archives in the country that every registered newspaper had to had to be sent to. And so when they got banned that third time in 62, they had a newspaper in reserve ready to go and didn't need to pay that deposit. So by then, this really annoyed the apartheid regime, and they went after the individuals and house arrested them and forbade them from working on a paper. And by the end of March in 63, the entire political situation had evolved to the extent that there literally was nobody left with a political knowledge who was not either underground or in exile or in jail.
So then the editors left or went into exile.
Yeah, no, they closed the paper, and people basically went underground or fled if they hadn't been jailed. And, you know, within a couple months, you know, Cape Town, well, the whole country was, you know, transformed, and nobody was doing what they've been doing.
When you say transformed, how do you mean?
Well, I mean, 3 days after the paper closed, the 90 days law came into effect, which meant that the government could imprison you for 90 days without charging you. And they could renew that 90 days indefinitely. And so within weeks, they were arresting political people in the country and putting them in solitary confinement and torturing them and killing them. And the first couple people that they killed in detention were people related to the paper. Two of the most incredible books coming out of South Africa are memoirs of detention, one by Ruth First and one by Albie Sachs, both of whom worked for the newspaper, for The Guardian. And so they were just basically picking up people and jailing them, and other people went into hiding and were working politically underground, and then getting captured. And by the end of 1964, basically all political opposition activity inside South Africa had stopped completely.
That's really interesting.
It became, you know, completely a police state.
So how is the Guardian thought of today in South Africa? Is it remembered?
Well, no. I mean, it's interesting. There was a great tragedy with the end of the paper, was that one of the laws they passed was that you could not be, you cannot possess any back issues of the paper. And if you did, you went to jail. And a number of people were arrested under this law. So it was a serious law. So everybody had to, and they all did this, either throw away, burn, or mail away your copies.
Lord have mercy.
So literally, you know, you couldn't see, you couldn't hold the paper. It was obliterated from from memory. And so, you know, plus the incredible dislocation that went on in the 60s with people going to jail, people being killed, being put off into exile, you know, being intimidated. So that there was a great silence that fell down, and great myths arose about things like, you know, what had happened in the 1950s, like the Defiance Campaign or the Congress of the People, these sort of seminal activities of the ANC. But, you know, the kind of complexity, these stories like, oh, my God, we had this incredible newspaper, that all got washed away. So that people in the 90s, when I was working on this paper, unless they'd been politically active, knew nothing about it. And even today, you know, when I was there a couple weeks ago, people, you know, promoting the book, talking about a lot of old timers who had, you know, lived in South Africa, or had been politically active in the 40s and 50s, they remembered it, but nobody else did. You know, there's sort of no historical memory beyond the very few people who were politically active in the 50s.
How did any of the editors of the paper who survived sort of to see 94, did, like Bunting, were they kind of rehabilitated in any way?
Well, Bunting was this great classic story. He went into exile in 63, came back in 91, and while he was editing the newspaper in 52, he got elected to parliament as a white representative of the African people in the Cape. And he served that for a year, and then they kicked him out of parliament because he had been a communist in the 1940s, back when it was legal to be a communist. So they retroactively said, well, you can't be in parliament if you had been a communist.
Yeah.
So they kicked him out in October of 53. So in May of 1994, and for me, one of these like wonderful moments, he was elected again as
a
member of parliament and went back into parliament as the only ANC person who had, you know, already been there. So that was a great, you know, moment of, you know, I told you so.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking he's the kind of person that they put on stamps and things.
Right. Well, yes, but, you know, South Africa, I don't know, a lot of these kind of second-tier people, I mean, there's been a great glorification of Mandela, deification of Mandela, and around the world, within South Africa. And they, a lot of these kind of guys who were, you know, completely central. I mean, Brian was on the executive committee of the Communist Party for over 50 years and had been a member his entire life and, you know, 88 years. You know, he basically had, you know, lived the entire length of the party's history. And, you know, a lot of people didn't know who he was.
Yeah.
He, you know, a lot of figures have gotten lost in the slipstream.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Historically.
So tell us a little bit about your book tour. How was that received?
Well, it was the book's been published in South Africa by a university press, and they have it's a vastly different sort of scene in terms of book publishing and literary. Literary works, but people are very excited about it. I've been on the radio, and there's a network, television network, that has a documentary wing, and my book, the story of The Guardian, is a subject of the film that they're doing.
That's terrific.
They spent a day interviewing me.
That's terrific.
So there's a tremendous interest in the country about their political past, because
uh-huh.
as I say, for a lot of people of all races, they just weren't allowed to know about it.
And so there
is a great interest there, and the interest, you know, obviously is quite a lot less in the States. Because people mm-hmm. people just aren't interested in Africa nearly as much as they were in the early 90s.
Try to sell them medieval Russia, as I did for many years. That was, didn't work out very well. It was a bad business plan. It really didn't work out very well for me. Well, you've been very, very generous with your time, Jim. So we really thank you very, very much. And I'd like to close the interview with our traditional question. What are you working on now?
Well, I'm doing a couple different projects. One is I'm working on a book about the squash and tennis coach at Trinity College in Hartford,
mm-hmm.
Who's this famous guru of psychology and dealing with great athletes. And so that's a project I've been working on for a long time, and
mm-hmm.
Doing some freelancing and
mm-hmm.
and trying to stay afloat financially and
right.
hustling along.
I know what it's like. Yeah, that's good. That's good.
It's a never-ending process. So,
I'm sure that many people will listen to this podcast, and your phone will start to ring, and the and the contracts will roll in, and maybe even the publishers will start to work on Friday or in August or something. I don't. Yeah, exactly. Well, thank you really, really very much for being on the show. I enjoyed the book very much, and I encourage people to go buy it. The book is, again, The Guardian, The History of South Africa's Extraordinary Anti-Apartheid Newspaper, and it's just come out from from Michigan State University Press here in the United States, and it's also available in South Africa if you happen to be listening from there. Jim, thanks very much for being on the show.
It's been a great pleasure.
All right, good enough. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
You've been listening to an interview with James Zug, the author of The Guardian, The History of South Africa's Extraordinary Anti-Apartheid Newspaper. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a good week, and I'll talk to you next week.